This is the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. So over the last couple of weeks, cinemas have been in a frenzy here in the capital as the 60th London Film Festival has been well underway with over 200 films from 74 different countries on show. There's been plenty to keep film critics and fanatics glued to their seats. One such is Jason Solomons, who's managed to tear his attention away from the screen just for 15 minutes or so to talk us through his highlights of this year's festival so far. Welcome to the show.
Thanks,
Jason.
Tom.
Now, it's interesting. I mean, I said there's been plenty on offer, but it is funny. It doesn't quite have the cachet or perhaps a sort of popular focus or attention that other well-known, you know, film festivals.
I know.
Have.
I mean,
is that changing, or do you think that is the case? And if
no,
so,
you're
why
right.
Is it?
Because I'm, you know, I'm here, and the London Film Festival draws to a close this weekend on Sunday night. And I say to my friends, I say, "What are you doing Sunday?" And I say, "Well, I'm going to the closing night." They say, "Well, of what?" And I said, "The film festival." They say, "Was that still going on, or has that even begun?" And they don't know. And I said, "Well, didn't you see photos of Kate Blanchett and Nicole Kidman everywhere?" And they say, "Well, maybe, but you get a photo." Some reason London is so big, you know. There's Frieze Art Fair going on. There's a play opening. You know, there's first nights of this. There's so much going on in a big city like London. New York suffers from the same thing. The New York Film Festival is a great festival up at the Lincoln Center. No one's ever heard of it. The city goes on like irrespective.
Well,
whereas it shuts down.
And it's not because the program doesn't have plenty on offer or there's great voices who are on display.
Absolutely. I mean, it's
just too busy,
very
perhaps.
Very good. The London Film Festival. People are missing it. But I mean, there's also other films coming out as well. You know, that there are at the same time. So you go to the cinema, you can go to some really good events that aren't even part of the London Film Festival. It's just the kind of way things are in a big city, I guess. But I'm very pleased that we do have the London Film Festival. So between you and me, Tom, it's really good. Go next year.
Well, exactly. So let's delve a bit deeper into why that is. And one thing I know, Jason, that you were sort of keen to stress here is that London broadly may be not wearing its best diversity hat over the last few months for one reason or another. Let's draw a brush over that. But in the world of film, you know, London does diversity well.
Yeah, well, maybe the UK is not so great at diversity. I think London's pretty good at being diverse.
We voted the right way.
I think
in the Brexit
we did.
Let's not get into that.
But there were debates at this London Film Festival, industry debates about what to do post Brexit. Is it business as usual for film? Is film even the big issue? You know, people talking about, you know, can you get crews across the borders? You know, if there's freedom of movement restriction, what are we going to do with my camera crew who's Polish and German and the grips from Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia?
Were people confident just on that point?
They're confident. No, it's a huge worry. No, they're not confident at all. Because they don't know. I mean, we're back into known unknowns and unknown knowns. It's like Rumsfeld running the film business. But it's the same as any other business. Currency fluctuation. We do know that the Americans are coming to the UK thinking, great, I can make a few blockbusters here for cheap money and then get out very quickly before anyone's worked out what we're doing. We're open to exploitation there as well. What interests me as a watcher is, are the stories going to change? I mean, yes, it's hard to get a crew into Switzerland and Denmark if you want to shoot over there, but are the stories on the screen actually going to change? Are people going to be writing kind of things that kind of either bind Europe together, or are people going to be writing films that kind of go, yeah, British films for British people? I don't know, and I
guess
couldn't
it depends.
Work out.
Maybe it depends how bad the situation gets, because we know that filmmakers are often in the front rank of creativity when it comes to the most challenging of circumstances. So maybe if we really go to hell in a handcart,
sure,
we'll see the next great generation.
It takes about 5 years to make a film. You know, someone writes it, someone goes, money, then they cast it and they can't get it. So, but 5 years later, it's like, oh, it's a bit behind, après la lettre, if you like. So that, no one seemed to know what was going on. They were saying that don't panic, we'll be all right, because the French aren't going to stop making UK co-productions. The Germans, they're still going to like our movies, although the French don't like our costume dramas at all. So they do like our costume dramas, like socials, they don't like our rom-coms. So certain things travel well. That's been fascinating. But the diversity on display has been a very sort of measured response by the BFI, the British Film Institute, to kind of highlight the lack of black performers in particular this year. There was a black symposium, and they opened with a film about David Oyelowo marrying Rosamund Pike. I mean, their characters as the King of Botswana, a film called A United Kingdom by a black British filmmaker, Ama Asante. It was a decent film. It was all right. I didn't love it, but it's good. Then there was David Oyelowo again in Mira Nair's Queen of Katwe, which also featured a great role for Lupita Nyong'o, her major role after 12 Years a Slave, set in the slums of Kampala, about a teenage chess project. I mean, it's a real Disney movie about this kind of sports movie, this kind of teenage kid slumdog millionaire style rising from the slums. But in Mira Nair's hands, it actually became brilliant. It was very, almost subversive. It's kind of the most radical Disney movie ever. It had teenage prostitution and poverty and all of this in there.
I miss that, because I miss when those used to crop up in the old Disney films.
Yeah, exactly. You never saw Dumbo, did you?
Exactly. Maybe not for want of trying. What about Moonlight? Because I know this is one that really, really, really grabbed you. Tell us what that is and why that made such an impact.
Yeah, it was probably my favourite film, Discovery of the Festival. I hope it wins the award for best feature in the official programme. It's by a filmmaker I'd never heard of called Barry Jenkins. It's set in sort of Florida, and it's about the emotional life of a little black kid from when he's a real kid, like 5 years old, then through when he's teenage years, and then into when he's late 20s, when he's become a drug dealer. But it's about a love story. It's such a delicate, beautiful movie, so strange, that I don't want to spoil and say what it's about, because I feel that some of the people are marketing it or reporting it wrong. They're saying it's about sexuality, and it isn't about that. It's a love story, for sure, and it's an emotional growth story. It was based on a play which has got the most gorgeous title, which I only just found this out, called Black Boys in the Moonlight Shine Blue, which I think is just lovely. It's a very American thing to have the title for a play.
Poetic.
But it's a gorgeous, the soul music's in it, the rap music's in it. It's got, who's brilliant in it? Janelle Monáe. She's a brilliant actress. She's really good in it. Mahershala Ali is fantastic in it. And the kid in the end, it just knocked me for six, Moonlight. I hope you'll be seeing a lot more of it. It's one of those little indie movies that can really go all the way to the Oscars, I think. But it requires gentle handling. But I'm so glad I saw it I wouldn't have seen this were it not for the London Film Festival.
There you go. We're back to where we started. And just in terms of like across the board, do you think that there is progress being made here? What people talk about, you know, how representative is the silver screen, how truly democratic is it as a business? Again, once Brexit worries aside, do you think there's a danger of complacency, or do you think people are still very interested across the board in making sure that their industry, you know, is a good industry and a balanced and a fair industry?
I think they're desperate for it to be sort of diverse and risk-taking, and at least on the screen, but off-screen it is just the opposite of that. It is not diverse. It is so risk-averse. It is extraordinary. So it's odd because they want to promote the stories that are kind of, you know, inspirational and kind of edgy, but no one around them is inspirational and edgy. I mean, it's quite
And why does that happen? Is that because, I don't know, maybe the people who are financing the movies don't quite have the same agenda as...
It is definitely a money thing. I mean,
what's the secret to cracking that, then, do you think?
To be really
ask you the easy question,
because I know.
I think
it's about writers and risk takers and changing the decision makers is what David Ayala was saying. But that doesn't mean the decision makers can change. But the money's got to come from somewhere. This is an expensive thing. Listen, film may get more democratic. We may get more indie filmmakers. As Shane Meadows comes along once in a generation to change it, and even then they become sort of party to money and distribution and all of that. It is an expensive process. Maybe the democratization of screens and mobile phones and tablets and Amazons and all of these streaming services may just kind of throw up the odd gem. But, you know, you've seen the stuff that's on Amazon and Netflix at the moment. It's rubbish.
A long way to go, perhaps. Let's keep it lofty, though, Jason. So let's talk about some of the other things that have caught your eye at the festival. I wanted to ask you in particular about Lady Macbeth. It's quite stark. I mean, it's sort of a brutal piece, but it's not the sinister Shakespearean version.
No,
this follows a woman trapped in a loveless marriage.
Yeah, I mean, it's called Lady Macbeth, and I thought it's not Shakespeare. It's based on a play called Lady Macbeth of Villeneuve from 1865. Never heard of it.
Usual spelling.
Yeah. directed by a theatre director I've never heard of called William Oldroyd, starring a young girl who came to prominence in Carol Morley's film The Falling last year, and this is her first lead show. She's called Florence Pugh. She's a young actress from Oxfordshire, I believe. She is extraordinary as the Lady of the Manor. She kind of gets married into this kind of really heartless family living somewhere in the north. It's kind of Newcastle-ish, kind of whatever moors are up there, and Northumberland-y type thing. And she's kind of lumbered with this loveless husband and his dad, and a brutal kind of moor household, and she has to kind of run it in a way. But it's a terrible house that kind of creaks, and in the end she ends up kind of falling for the stable boy. It's called Lady Macbeth, and it's about her cold-eyed ambition and her passion, and her it's almost a scary movie. You know, it's absolutely stark, as you say, but after 5 minutes I was like, why are we making this? What's this about? Then I was absolutely gripped by it. She's brilliant, Florence Pugh, and it's got interesting things to say about race without saying them. They sort of just cast differently. It's very, very interesting, Lady Macbeth. I think it's the most sort of arresting first feature I've seen at the festival, and I hope it wins the Sutherland Award, which is for such things.
High praise indeed. Let's take a quick listen. This is from Lady Macbeth.
You know I shan't be parted from your life, Sebastian. Through hell and high water, I will follow you. To the cross, to the prison, to the grave, to the sky.
Maybe not not loads of laughs, but good challenging stuff nevertheless.
It's not a lot of laughter. But sometimes I do feel that, you know, with the Lars von Trier like that, I thought, like, it kind of reminds me slightly of Breaking the Waves. Not a lot of laughs. But actually for this one, I didn't think laughs was appropriate. There are some funny bits, you know, there's some kind of darkly comic moments, I suppose, but it's sexy and erotic, and, you know, there's not a lot of laughs in Macbeth, to be honest with you, either.
No, I've read
it. That's quite good.
I think you're right. Lady Macbeth premiered at Toronto Film Festival this year, and cinema release dates are yet to be announced, but definitely one to keep an eye on. Jason, it's interesting. I think, you know, we talked before in this programme about, you know, filmmakers who are obsessed with making films about making films, and this kind of inward looking way of looking at things within the trade. And there's a documentary called Have You Seen My Movie, which is a film, I guess, about watching films, or is it about films in which people watch films? Tell us about this one.
All of those things, Tom. You're right. It is amazing how often filmmakers make films about people going to the movies and how often those scenes cropped up. And this has obviously occurred to this artist, Paul Anton Smith, who's made this composite movie, which is comprised of about 1,000 clips from 1,000 different movies about the whole experience of going to the cinema. So we start with lots of scenes of people buying tickets and getting their popcorn and in the cinema queue. Like, there's the Woody Allen bit in Annie Hall where they're queuing up.
One of my favourites.
It has to be in there. But there's so many more. There's Eva Green and Michael Pitt from The Dreamers kind of coming in and moving seat. There's people shuffling along. I mean, it's just, you can't believe there's so many. And then it's about people sitting in the movies watching them. There's the popcorn, the groping, the snogging, the being scared, the crying, the scenes, shootouts. It almost takes you through the whole experience of being in the cinema and watching a movie through the medium of the movies. I mean, metatextually, I think it's really smart, but it's also just great fun and entirely romantic, because it's all set in theatres. You know, there's no one watching them on a mobile phone here. You know, this is about that experience of the communal, almost religious experience of watching.
And definitely one for the film buff, I guess, with so many different
references. Oh my God, you'll just be going, oh,
throughout.
I know that one.
But it's interesting you said about Paul Anton Smith, because it's his first film, and he'd worked with, I guess probably some of our listeners will be familiar with The Clock, the amazing
Christian
Markley piece. Is this then it's a film, or is it kind of an art piece? Does it sort of blur the lines?
Well, it's interesting. It is quite long. It's about 218 minutes. But and I spoke to the filmmaker, and he sort of said, well, the first bit, the sort of first 20-minute opening sequence, is designed to be playing while people are coming into the cinema. So in truth, you're not supposed to watch that bit. That's supposed to be just a sort of intro, which is odd, because it's one of the great bits. It's got that Woody Allen bit in it, and the bit where Mia Farrow and Purple Rose of Cairo comes in and gets ready. You know, it's... So, yes, it's both of those things. He hasn't cleared the rights, you know. I mean, people, De Niro...
Let's hope no lawyers are watching.
But I think it's allowed at a festival. It's in the experimenter strand. So, yes, it's not quite a documentary. It is an installation-type piece, and it can play that way. And it slightly reminded me of Douglas Gordon's work a bit, although funnier. I mean, I absolutely adored it. I mean, because you're doing the quiz thing, sort of saying, oh, I know that bit. Well, that's by John Goodman. That must be in Barton Fink. But, I mean, there are 1,000 there, and I mean, I don't know how many I got, but I didn't get the full 1,000, that's for sure. There's this weird bit with Peter Sellers, and it's not just Hollywood, you know, there's British stuff in, there's French stuff, Jean-Pierre Léaud from 400 Blows, really good stuff, but you will be kind of waiting for the credits and kind of, you know, ticking them off. It's really, really, really smart. And there's a bit where everyone watches the sort of, the ending is, it's not to ruin it at all, because there's no spoilers in it, but the Casablanca becomes one of the main things, and everyone's crying, and it's about those responses that we get to the image, and I think that's why it could be an art piece as well. But I just let it flow as a movie. It almost works in itself as a movie. I mean, great cast.
Well, exactly. Quite literally a cast of thousands.
Yeah. Marilyn Monroe, Humphrey Bogart. I don't know how much you pay them all.
Great fun. Have you seen my movie? This is one of the finds of the festival, Jason says. Finally, Jason, time is short, but I did want to ask you a little bit about American Honey before the end of the programme. It's a road trip movie, been a big sort of hit on the kind of festival circuit, really. And I think it's in cinema screens now for people who want to dip in and see it for themselves. Why should they do so? If indeed you think that they should.
I do think they should. It played at Cannes, won another prize for Andrew Arnold at Cannes, and is now finally here. It did play at the London Film Festival and is now on general release. You know what? It's like a modern musical. The soundtrack is fantastic. Features like Lady Antebellum, Bruce Springsteen, Rihanna, and lots of other artists I'd never heard of. And it's about these kids kind of riding around America in a van, listening to music, and kind of it made me want to. Someone said to me, "Oh, I'll tell you why you should see it." Because someone said to me, "Oh, that film made me feel really old." And I said, "You know what? Exactly the opposite. It made me feel really young. I wanted to leave home, run away, and just kind of, you know, go across America." Don't think my wife and children would be too happy about it. But through the auspices of Andrew Arnold, Andrea Herndon. I can do that, yes.
And tell me a bit about Andrea Arnold, just briefly, because this is the first of her films outside the kind of UK setting, which probably fans of her work will be familiar with. It sounds from what you say, this is an artist at the top of their game who's made that transition very comfortably.
I think if you've liked Fish Tank and Red Road and what that gritty social realism that she's done, that Loach type stuff, it's all in American Honey as well, but it's got a bit of Malick layers she's added to that, and it's kind of really into something unique and of her own voice. And in a way, you feel like this is the film actually she really wanted to make. It is cool, it is funky, it is beautiful, it's sad, it's kind of erotic, and it's kind of exotic at the same time. So that's enough reasons to dip into American Honey.
That's plenty enough adjectives. Lovely stuff. American Honey's out in cinemas today, and the London Film Festival continues through till the end of the weekend.
Sunday night.
That's the end of today's show. What a Whistle Stop Tour. Jason Solomons, thanks very much for being with us, as always. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Our producer was Holly Fisher. The show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. My thanks to them too. Join us at the same time on Monday. We'll kick off the week with a chat about art. But for now, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.